Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Deathlands. Narrated by Richard Rowan. With performances by Terrence Aselford, Nanette Savard, Ken Jackson, Dolores King-Williams, Mort Shelby, Colleen Delaney, Christopher Graybill, James Lewis, David Coyne, James Konacek, Jason Stiles, Michael Glenn, Sherry Simpson, Scott McCormick, Karen Carbone, and MB Van Dorn. Deathlands number 36, Skydark. A whisper of chill, stale air crept along the Matran's chamber's armorglass walls, and with it came a whiff of something sharp and electric. As the raised metallic floor plates began to glow brighter, Ryan Cotter scanned the faces of his five friends. Only Christy returned his gaze, her green eyes steady. Though she held her head high and her long-limbed, statuesque body defiantly erect, he could tell that deep down she was anxious about the jump. Her prehensile mutant red hair had drawn close to her nape, retracting in response to danger. The woman's anxiety was understandable. The danger was very real, and close enough to taste. Mildred Wyeth sat beside Christy, with her eyes shut and her head bowed. The multiple beaded plaits of Mildred's hair swayed slightly as she clenched her hands into fists at her sides, her stocky form tensed as if to absorb a body blow. Whip-lean Jack Lauren stared blankly off in the middle distance. Though the expression in his ruby-colored eyes was unreadable, the tendons of his jaws flexed like steel cables under the waxy white of his scarred cheeks. J.B. Dix gripped the brim of his beloved fedora with both hands, twisting it down more firmly on his head. Behind the armorer's round, steel-rimmed spectacles, Ryan caught the glimmer of a sardonic smile. What was that old Predark saying? When the crapfall really got heavy, it was time to screw on your hat. Ryan turned to Doc Tanner last. The old man's eyes were tightly closed, his lips moving silently as he repeated a short phrase over and over. Ryan could lip-read and recognized the strange words. Doc, a fountainhead of obscure, dated, and often arcane knowledge, had taught him the phrase and its meaning. Morituri te salutamus. We who are about to die salute you. Ryan had no idea who or what Doc thought he was saluting, or if the old man even knew. The experience of having been time-trawled into the future had done something to the old man's mind. He didn't always talk rationally. A swirling gray mist appeared near the chamber's ceiling. Tendrils of the mist drifted down, obscuring everything. Ryan fell through the space where the floor should have been, spiraling downward, faster and faster through black emptiness. Somewhere in the middle of his windmilling fall, he completely lost consciousness, but not for long. The mind dreamed in transit, and the dreams were always bad. The instant of death-like oblivion was shattered by a surge of color, sound, and the full range of physical sensations. The jump dream had begun. It was night. He hit the ground running. His bare feet dug into moist soil as he raced toward a distant tower of flames. As he ran, he knew it wasn't his own body that carried him. It was too light, too quick, too strong for its size. The differences, the raw speed and the agility, amazed him. Effortlessly, he closed the gap between himself and a crude defensive wall of skinny, unpeeled logs, seated in a heaped, tamped earth. A narrow section of the tree trunk barrier was smoking. The axe sharpened tops of its logs shattered into fans of splinters, as if by a lightning strike. He slipped through a break in the wall and into the midst of a tiny, destitute build. Brian knew he had never been there before, but he had seen many outposts just like it, clinging for life at the edges of Deathlands. The nameless Ville's packed dirt courtyard was surrounded by a jumble of thatched roof shanties. Most of its 24 mud and stick huts were already burning. Beyond their steeply peaked roofs, at the rear of the compound, he could just make out the sawtooth top of the log wall. All around him in the humid darkness, the air hung heavy with a maddening perfume, the metallic scent of freshly spilled blood, and the sour smell of wood smoke. He caught the dim shapes of white limbs moving frantically at the edges of the firelight, the arms and legs of others like him, gleefully killing with bare hands and feet. His kin had already found their prey. He trembled, not from the exertion of the full-out run, but from excitement. Heat radiated from his very core, surging through his limbs and his face. It was the heat of desire, of an unquenchable hunger. Even as the heat billowed outward, it seemed to compress his lungs in hoops of steel, forcing him to sip greedily for air. He turned slowly, taking in every detail of the grim scene, the fires, the brutal murders of the Ville's people and their livestock, the wanton destruction. Everything he saw as he turned, everything he felt, was new and fascinating. The gunshot froze Ryan. It was from inside the Ville's perimeter. There was still at least one survivor. Wayne crossed the courtyard, homing in on the source of the sound, a shabby hut. When he tried the front door of the shabby hut, it wouldn't open, even to a full-force kick. It was heavily barred from the inside. Without a thought, he climbed the hut's front wall as quick as a lizard, scampering up onto the thatched roof. He peered down through the ragged hole that had been torn in the thatch. The room below him was lit by rows of guttering candles, illuminating several corpses around a long table. Ryan dropped 25 feet, landing softly on the killing floor. Three adults and four children lay face down in the middle of their evening meal. Ryan sniffed at one of the crude wooden bowls, recognizing boiled mashed roots, boiled mashed beans, boiled prickly leaves. It was a gray-green, tasteless Last Supper. The rough-hewn table was puddled with the blood of the seven diners. From the eye sockets up, the tops of their skulls had been ripped off, the contents plundered, splattered and smeared over the clay-colored interior walls. Their arms and legs were cracked and twisted into impossible positions, their necks grotesquely bent. The sweet stench of gore suffused the warm, moist air. It made it even harder for Ryan to breathe. A surge of internal heat, more powerful than anything he had yet felt, slammed him. He had the sudden urge to throw himself into the pool of blood spreading across the tamped earth floor, the urge to roll and wallow in it. At some deeply submerged level of mind, Ryan recognized the alien nature of the thought and recoiled. Though he tried, he couldn't stop himself from kneeling and touching the spilled blood. Nor could he stop himself from feeling disappointment when he realized it had already gone cold. He examined the floor. Multiple bloody footprints led away from the red pool. And then he caught a faint whiff of a familiar fishy odor. Kin on the hunt. His strange new body's response was automatic. Ryan leapt over the blood and through the yawning doorway beyond. It opened onto a cramped, dark room where rude straw pallets were spread out on the ground. At one end of the room, a door to the outside stood ajar. He peered cautiously around the jamb. The doorway looked onto a small lane that separated the ragged line of huts. Lit by the nearby burning rooftops, the dirt track lay heaped with still thrashing white bodies, his kin tangled up in yards of their own spilled bowels. Only one creature remained standing in the narrow lane. The enemy. A tall, rangy, and powerfully built man bent over a fresh corpse, trying to pry the first 6 inches of a long-bladed knife from the center of its bony chest. With his back to Ryan, the black-haired foe braced the sole of his boot on the dead face while he savagely levered the knife handle back and forth. The sight sent a wave of righteous hatred and rage coursing through Ryan's blood. Under the hate and the rage, and more terrible than either, he felt a surge of pure delight. Delight in what he knew to be his own vastly superior physical strength. Delight in the destruction he was about to visit upon the unwary man. In a single cat-like bound, Arms outstretched, he crossed the space between the doorway and his target. He slammed onto the enemy's back. He caught hold and drove him forward, but not down as he had planned. With a combination of balance and strength, the man managed to keep his feet despite the sudden impact. Ryan's arms whipped in a blur, hands tearing at the broad shoulders. Cloth gave way, presenting him with bare, warm skin. Ryan snatched hold and pulled as hard as he could. The skin stretched and stretched until it could stretch no more. And then it began to rip loose from the dense layers of muscle underneath. The man whirled, punching and kicking, trying to throw him off. Ryan held on, riding his enemy like a wild horse. And when the man paused for breath, he repositioned his grip. As he moved his hands, he saw the torn strips of skin, the bright, slick blood, and rows of round red welts he had left behind. Suddenly, everything made sense. The speed, the uncanny climbing ability, the animal urges. Even as Ryan realized with a pang of horror what the welts meant, what kind of subhuman mutated body he possessed, his body slapped a hand against the side of the man's face. The tiny suckers that lined his fingers and palms seized the flesh of cheek, nose, and forehead. Bracing a knee in the middle of his enemy's back, he used all his power to twist the straining corded neck and draw the chin toward him over the top of the bleeding shoulder. The dark-haired man had a single eye, blue and full of hate. The empty socket on the other side of his face was covered by a patch, which only partly concealed the old blade scar that split eyebrow and cheek. It was like looking into a mirror. The life Ryan Carter was about to take was his own. Then, something even stranger began to happen. He started to hurt. Bad. For a terrible instant, Ryan floundered in a jumble of conflicting viewpoints and sensations. His world blurred as two different sets of images from two different sets of eyes, murderers and victims, were superimposed on one another. His consciousness inhabited both of the struggling dream bodies at once, but he couldn't control either. The aggressor couldn't let go, the victim couldn't break free. Simultaneously, Ryan felt exquisite pleasure and unendurable pain as the tendons that anchored face to bone snapped and the brutally drawn flesh tore free from the front of his skull. Victim Ryan's head wrenched back with such force that his neck vertebrae shattered, severing his spinal cord. Blackness cut through Ryan's consciousness like a sword slash, dividing him from the slumping human form. And once more, there was only one creature standing in the narrow, corpse-littered lane. Straddling the broken human body, Ryan the Victor clutched in his suckered fist a bloody rag of muscle and sinew, and dangling by its torn nerve bundle, one intensely blue eye. A huge bonfire beat against Mildred's bare back in scorching waves. Of their own accord, her legs responded to the erratic rhythm of the heat, propelling her around the edge of the blaze in a jittery, jerky, arm-waving dance. Between her toes, the earth was gooey soft, churned to muck by the footsteps of the dozens of others who circled the fire with her. Numbed by the pleasure she felt, Nota danced through roiling clouds of rank smoke, through showers of golden sparks. As she jigged and hopped, her arms pumping overhead, something in the heart of the pyre exploded, hurling chunks of flaming wood like miniature comets across the courtyard. Wood wasn't the only thing burning or flying. Hot, wet gouts of flesh spattered her bare breasts, stomach, and thighs. For the first time, Mildred looked down and took note of her dream body. Its stark whiteness stunned her. She stopped dancing, letting the other celebrants brush past her. Her limbs weren't dark brown as they should have been, but pale as ash. And they were the wrong shape, too. Not muscular and heavy-boned, but slender, almost fragile. When she turned over her hands, she saw the rows of tiny suckers that lined their mutated palms. A chill of horror crept up the back of her neck. A wall of blast furnace heat rolled over Mildred. It was so intense that she had to jump away or have her skin blistered. As she whirled, the burst of heat penetrated her from head to foot. Like an exotic drug, lubricated her joints, her belly, and made her brain bubble and froth. Instantly, her concern over what she had become vanished, and the lithe, pale body resumed its erratic dance. At the edge of the firelight, she could make out the smoldering ruins of her little village. A group of scrawny, white-limbed figures rushed from the deep shadows, bearing more fuel for the pyre. Some carried great armloads of thatch, broken pieces of furniture, piles of the pathetic personal belongings of the Ville's inhabitants, lice-infested straw beds, flea-ridden furs, and coarsely woven blankets. Others ran forward in pairs, dragging limp human bodies between them by the heels or wrists that they threw on the pyre. Fountains of sparks shot into the black sky. Trembling, charred hands reached out through the curtain of fire, clutched at nothingness, and fell back. Mildred's human spirit retreated in horror from the sight, even as her strange new body delighted in it, spinning and capering in ecstasy. In her wild exuberance, she collided with a fellow reveler. The impact bounced her from the dance track at the edge of the bonfire. She stumbled and slipped on the muddy ground. As she caught herself with a hand, she looked up. 50 feet away, at the edge of the light, stood another figure, impossibly tall and as still as a statue. Obviously, enormously male, its gleaming oiled body was hairless and naked, but for a knotted loincloth and combat boots. The giant had odd piebald markings on his skin, brown cloud shadows crawling over his snowy whiteness. A bandolier of black-tipped cartridges hung across his massive chest and shoulders, ammo for his weapon, the mother of all shoulder-fired weapons. In his hands, the M60 machine gun looked like a child's toy. He didn't have the look of kin, nor the familiar rank-sour smell. He looked and smelled like the god he was. Mildred prostrated herself before him, pressing her face deep into the mud. Kill or die, there was nothing she wouldn't do for him. When she raised her face, he gestured sharply with the machine gun, acknowledging her supplication and releasing her from it. Mildred crawled backward on her belly. When she rose and turned again to the pyre, a great plume of sparks shot skyward. Again, it just fed it more fuel. Mildred's body responded to the sudden surge in heat with an instant jerk dance. She tried desperately to wake up, to end the nightmare, but to no avail. Buffeted by the heat, she continued to dance like an automaton, drool sliding down her chin and throat and glistening between her rock-hard breasts. Christy dreamed she was climbing, hand over foot, up an incredibly steep incline. She moved joyously, as light and quick as a spider, across a great, mist-shrouded gray cliff. As she scaled the face, reality began to shift and skew. The incline's sheer vertical surface started to sway and ripple under her weight. It felt more like a net ladder woven from rope than a mountain of rock. As she continued upward through the blinding fog, she realized that it wasn't made of rope either. The hand and footholds she climbed were warm and smooth and electric to the touch. Then the wall she climbed but couldn't see undulated. The rhythmic motion stirred something inside Christy, sending a tickle of excitement rushing from the base of her skull to the base of her spine. Suddenly, the fog began to lift, and things came into sharp, startling focus. Not only was the cliff, the net, the wall beneath her alive, it was made up of thousands of creatures, their arms and legs laced together, interlinked chains of pale, naked beings. Christy raised her bare foot to her shoulder and gripped the front of the thigh above, pulling herself higher. She smelled sour sweat from the bald head of the creature upon whose back she climbed, felt the seething animal heat. The brush of skin against skin told her that she too was naked. She looked up to see that the tapestry of bodies hung from some indistinct point out of sight overhead. It wasn't made of a single sheet of living beings, but many sheets laid one on top of another, and layers of individual creatures locked as she was now, chest to back, chest to back, chest to back. From below, a hand closed around her ankle and yanked. Christy braced herself and lashed out with a savage mule kick. Her heel made solid contact with the face, and the hand released her foot. She glanced over her shoulder and saw a white body pinwheeling away from the living wall. And as it did, it crashed into the climbers below, creating a chain reaction, an avalanche. Dozens of white forms were knocked free and sent tumbling thousands of feet before they disappeared into the mist. Their deaths panicked and momentarily froze the hundreds of other pursuers swarming up the web. Christy felt a delirious exaltation. No one could stop her. As she climbed higher and higher, The interlinked creature she passed over became noticeably larger and stronger. They had to be in order to maintain their position in the chain of bodies. The strongest of all were at the very top. They were the most desirable mates. Even as Christie suddenly understood the purpose of her dream body's superhuman effort, she felt a strange pull, an arching ache in her groin. She looked down at herself in astonishment. She had no breasts, and she was most definitely a male. A sexually excited male. The man member jerked upward, seemingly with a will of its own. Watching it, she felt a tangible sense of loss. Whoever, whatever she was now, she was no longer Christy Roth, no longer connected to a long line of highly evolved females. Her Earth Mother power had been replaced by the more obvious and much less imposing prod between her legs. Even as she grieved for her femininity, a passion, an animal need swept over her. It was like nothing she'd ever felt before. The body she inhabited knew what it wanted. The body would not be denied.
No.
She could see a creature moving up off her, with small breasts and sturdy thighs and hands. Waves of heat washed over Christy's face and down her chest. Unable to control the body, she retreated into herself, crawling as far away from the alien sensations as she could. Though her body tried to overtake the creature, it couldn't. Its quarry had too great a lead. The creature reached the top of the chain, and once there, clasped itself onto the back of what looked to be a huge male. Despite her attempt to curl up and hide, Christy found herself experiencing everything her body felt. She was a helpless passenger as it moved into position on the creature's back. As with a suckered hand, it guided its upstanding member under the unprotected buttocks, nosing it into the warm, moist crevice it found there. Trapped inside the male body, swept away in its hormone storm, Christy momentarily lost touch with her real-world identity. She wanted only what the body wanted. She thrust deep into the clinging softness. Ecstasy swallowed her up. Then, a hand from below gripped her foot, then her hip. Christy felt the weight of another creature on her back. It was enormous. A rough hand reached under her buttocks as something thick and hard nudged against her. Pleasure, very familiar, very feminine, exploded between her legs. It brought her back to herself in a headlong rush. The unmistakable sensation told her that her dream body had two sets of sex organs, one male, the other female, both fully operational. As did all the creatures in the living web. As her body lunged forward, the creature she rode turned its head and opened its wet mouth. Christy stared into a white, flabby face, framed by a bald pate. The eyes were unreadable, flat, as dead as a doll's. The teeth like yellow nail points. Sticky. Christy's spirit fought with all its strength, but there was no escaping the predicament. Unable to break free of the grip of the creature that had mounted her, wedged in front and back, lost in lubricous thrusting pleasure, Christy panicked, flailing in the darkness of the alien skull. Her real self wasn't just lost and adrift. It was drowning. It was dying. There was no Gaia power in this feverish universe. Nothing and no one to come to her aid. Christy knew with a terrible certainty that she would be impregnated by the great thing on her back, that her belly would swell and swell until she staggered under its weight, and that soon she would give birth to a gaggle of needle-toothed, dead-eyed monsters. As that realization sank home, at the edge of consciousness, she sensed an onlooker, a shadowy presence lurking beyond her field of view, a presence of pure and perfect evil, which stepped forward into the light of her mind. Not just a bystander, this, or a mere watcher. This was a ringmaster with steel eyes. Ryan awakened on his hands and knees on the gateway floor. As he clung to it, the gleaming surface seemed to dip and swirl, and the chamber's violet-tinted armorglass wall spun wildly around him. Strands of acrid bile dangled from his parted lips. His mind reeled with more than the usual post-jump confusion. He had suffered an awful defilement, a rape of the soul that not even a lifetime of Deathlands horrors had prepared him for. Against his will, He had been forced to share space, breath, heartbeat with the mutated and inhuman. The gateway chamber reeked of vomit. Slowly, like a curtain rising, the Matran's haze lifted from his brain. It was then that he realized there were too many legs, arms, and bodies inside the sealed chamber. With an effort, he focused. Inches away, two huge eyes looked back at him from a pale, hairless face. Black eyes, alive, but dead to feeling, to sympathy, to mercy. Below the eyes were tiny nostrils centered in moist flab, and its mouth was lined with rows of pointed, vulpine teeth. Suddenly, the sticky lashed out. A cold, sucker-lined hand slapped against Ryan's face, covering mouth, nose, and cheek. Suckers failed to attach themselves to the man's flesh. As he bounced the back of the sticky's head onto the floor, Ryan glimpsed other muties sprawled and tangled in the hexagonal-shaped chamber. His companions were outnumbered 2-1. He started to reach for the handgun on his hip, a 9mm 6-hour semi-automatic, but thought better of it. At point-blank range in the close confines of the chamber, the high-velocity Full Metal Jacket slugs would undoubtedly drill through the stickies and hit either his companions or the armor-glass walls. Hopping into a low crouch, Ryan drew his punga from its sheath. The sticky started to rise. Ryan brought the knurled steel pommel of the 18-inch blade down on the hairless head in a full-power arc. Even as it fell, the other stickies began to rouse themselves, sitting up and blinking in the harsh artificial light. Ryan gripped the shoulder of Doc's frock coat and gave him a hard shake.
Brad blasted, Doc! Get up!
JB and Jack, though obviously still dazed, pushed themselves to their knees. Ryan stepped to Mildred's side.
Get up and fight! Fight now or we all die!
Christy was the only one who didn't respond. She lay curled in a fetal position, her back against the violet armor glass, separated from Ryan and the others by a knot of stickies. The band of killer muties hurled themselves across the slippery floor, charging their enemies. Doc slid his sword free of its cane scabbard. Fearless in the face of the sticky's fury, his narrow, straight, double-edged blade flicked like a steel serpent's tongue, driving in and out of the pale body in a red-tinged blur. Ryan pivoted around the sticky charge, skating on the nasty slick floor to get between Christy and the pair of muties who had turned to attack her. Bracing himself, he made a mighty two-handed slash with his ponga. The keen blade clipped through both of them at waist height, cutting off their arms at the elbows, dropping their coiled guts to the floor. As Mildred tried to stand to meet the attack, she slipped in the slimy mess underfoot. Her faltering step made the onrushing sticky lose its target. The sucker hand missed her head by less than an inch and slammed against the armor-glass wall. It stuck there, trapped by its own suckers for a second, long enough for Mildred to unholster her ZKR-551. As the creature hurtled like a ragdoll toward the far wall, it knocked down four of its comrades. Ryan moved in on them with his ponga. Still infected by the dream, Ryan exercised his loathing for the debased species, making these few pay dearly for his nightmare. Jack ducked under the crazed rush of a trio of muties. The teenager spun and struck like a poison-spitting cobra. Leaf-bladed throwing knives leapt from his hand to the unguarded necks of the stickies. Ryan whirled and saw the last surviving sticky clinging to JB's back, riding him out of the open chamber doorway. Fighting to keep his balance, the armorer tripped over the portal and crashed to the floor of the brightly lit room outside. The sticky's weight came down on top of him, but JB already had the slim, polished steel of his techno knife clutched in his fist. He thumbed the button in the butt of the knife's handle, and the metal sheath flicked back, exposing a bright scalpel blade. As the sticky ripped off his hat and glasses, JB reached back and slashed at the joint of the mutie's hip and thigh, deftly slitting the femoral artery. Though its blood pulsed out in great gouts, the sticky refused to die. It grabbed hold of its enemy with both hands and started tearing at his neck. Ryan jumped from the gateway chamber and with a downward slash of his ponga, cleaved the creature's right arm off at the shoulder. Lightning fast, he brought the long knife swinging around in a tight horizontal arc. The sticky's head fell from its neck. With Mildred's help, Ryan managed to pry the dead but still strangling fingers from their friend's throat.
Scab-ass bastard wanted to take me to hell with him.
Hey, somebody? Need a hand here?
Jack stood in the Matran's chamber's entry. He held Christy draped against his hip. Her head lolled loose on her shoulders, and her prehensile red hair hung in limp strands. Her long, slender legs wouldn't support her weight. Ryan moved to him and scooped Christy into his arms.
I got her, Jack.
As he carried her over to a desktop, Ryan could feel the shallow and rapid rise and fall of her breathing, and he was grateful for it. Ryan gently laid her down on the desk, then stepped back so Mildred could give her an immediate examination. Standing by and watching the procedure served no purpose, except to make the one-eyed man feel helpless and impatient, so while the doctor worked, he and Jack re-entered the chamber and retrieved the weapons and gear they had dropped during the close-quarters battle. Doc leaned against the edge of a desktop, his brow furrowed, lost in a troubled reverie, until Jack prodded him with the tip of his swordstick's ebony sheath. The old man jerked violently at the unexpected touch. He pointed his rapier at the headless body on the floor.
By the three Kennedys! Foul incubus! Phantasm of the dunghill! What cruel joke Morpheus has played and made me its clefted fundament!
His companion stared at Doc, uncomprehending.
Though I am loath to admit it, during our recent journey I dreamed I was one of those unspeakable creatures.
That's very odd. The same thing happened to me, and it was the most awful jump nightmare I've ever had. Makes my skin crawl to remember it.
When the doctor looked at Jack, the ruby-eyed teenager scowled back unpleasantly, but said nothing.
I had a dream like that, too. And my dream stunk almost as bad as what's in there.
JB jerked a thumb at the pale corpses heaped inside the Matt Trans chamber.
I can fix it.
As quick as a cat, Jack moved to close the door.
Fireblast, you know better, Jack. If you close the door, more of the earless bastards can come through the gateway.
The truth of his words hung in the air, as cold and certain as death. As far as the six travelers knew, the race of homicidal mutants known as Stickies had never used a gateway before. Now that the Stickies had apparently taken their first Matt Trans leap and arrived as Ryan and company lay on the floor recovering, they had to face the possibility that they had done it on purpose. If indeed that was the case, the dead-eyed whirlwinds of slaughter and destruction could pop up anywhere, anytime.
Maybe they just stumbled in, wandered in like stoops and accidentally tripped the unit. Or maybe they didn't jump at all. Maybe they found the entrance to this redoubt open and were poking around inside the chamber when we arrived.
No, not come to here.
Jack pointed at the floor, which gleamed under banks of fluorescent lights. Tracks in the yellow vomit on the light gray linoleum led away from the Matrans chamber in uncountable numbers, growing fainter as they crossed the broad, windowless room. Jack crouched and touched a footprint with his index finger, then rubbed it with his thumb.
Still wet.
For a second, above the riot of nauseating odors in the room, Ryan could smell them. Not their puke, them. In his life, Ryan had killed many Stickies hand-to-hand, face-to-face, but never before had he noticed that particular smell. Then he remembered the source of the olfactory cue. It had come from the nightmare. Trapped in a mutant dream body, he had recognized his fellow Stickies by the distinctive scent they left behind. Now that he was wide awake and fully rematerialized, the telltale stench shouted at him like a pile of fish guts left 3 days in the sun. Not possible, Ryan told himself. Dreams, Matrans or otherwise, weren't real. He shook his head to clear it of still lingering jump ghosts. JB firmly seated his fedora back on his head.
Stickies are red blasted triple stoop. No way could they have jumped on purpose. Dark night, most of them can't even find their own pricks.
JB's right. None of the Stickies we've ever crossed paths with has shown much in the way of practical intelligence. 9 times out of 10, they don't even use simple weapons, like clubs and rocks, for their killing. I find it hard to believe that a bunch of gibbering idiots could organize themselves to do anything like this. Think about it. How could they possibly understand the process of matter transfer well enough to use it?
Maybe they're getting smarter.
Morituri te salutamus.
Oh, can it, you old fool.
Ryan shot the physician a warning glance. Now wasn't the time to reopen a personal squabble. He looked past Mildred to the desktop where Christy lay. Her breathing had deepened and slowed. Her prehensile hair no longer dangled limp and lank on her shoulders. It twitched and coiled around her face like a nest of irritated red snakes.
How's she doing?
She's severely disoriented from the jump. I can't find anything else physically wrong with her. Of course, that doesn't mean too much, considering the tools I have to work with. If I haven't missed something critical, I'd say she should snap out of it in a few minutes.
Can she be moved?
Sure.
Ryan, dear fellow, loath as I am to propose it, might we not risk embarking on another jump?
I'm afraid it's not an option in Christie's case. In her present condition, there's no telling what damage a second jump would do to her.
At this point, Doc, we aren't sure what the Stickies know about the gateway system. They could use it to follow us, and we could find ourselves fighting an army of the dead-eyed bastards wherever we end up.
Oh, wow! Wait a minute! There's a basic problem here that I think you're all missing. It's a matter of logic.
Dark Knight, our basic problem isn't logic, it's Stickies.
But...
No, Mildred. Save whatever it is for later. We don't have time to discuss it now. We're not safe here. The Stickies we just chilled might be missed by the others.
Ryan moved the still unconscious Christie into a sitting position and eased her over his left shoulder in a fireman's carry. With his Steyr SSG-70 rifle in his right hand, he headed for the elevators on the other side of the control complex. The other companions followed, keeping eyes open in all directions, just in case. Bolted to the wall beside the pair of elevators was a level-by-level map of the entire complex. From the schematic, they could tell that they were five stories down from the redoubt's vanadium steel exit doors.
Phew.
Place big.
One of the biggest we've come across.
Ryan scanned the index, row upon row of color-coded numbers and names that corresponded to points marked on the map. It was more than big. It was a small city. According to the map, the redoubt had its own hospital, residential areas, several theaters, four dining halls, two sports centers, various automated labs, machine shops, hydroponics gardens, all bunkered underground. In addition to the nuke fuel source that powered the complex, the map showed a fossil fuel storage cell and an armory.
Behold the promised Elysium, sanctuary for pre-dark potentates, snug harbor for bigwig white coats and military for well-heeled politicians and corporate CEOs.
Mildred took a careful look at the room behind them. The high-tech air filtration system kept the floors and elevated surfaces clean, but the corners, where the ceiling met the walls, were hung with funereal drapes of thick, gray cobwebs.
Doc, I think your VIPs got caught with their pants down on Doomsday. They never arrived at their own party.
Ryan adjusted Christie's weight on his shoulder.
Be ready. We're on triple red.
He poked the elevator's button with the muzzle of his rifle. As he moved to the side of the left-hand pair of doors, he slung the rifle over his shoulder and seized his Sig Sauer P226 with his free hand. The light went on behind the plastic arrow over the doors. Some sixth sense told Ryan that danger was very close. His finger was already pressing the trigger as the doors jerked apart. The four Stickies inside the elevator reacted to the sight of humans with amazing speed. In a blur of intentionally confusing arm-waving motion, they attacked. Blown onto their backs on the floor, a quartet of muties thrashed their arms as they tried desperately to get up. JB stepped forward with his Uzi. The elevator doors started to close. Jack reached out and stopped them.
Where to? Out?
Before we leave, we better check out the armory. Maybe we'll get lucky this time and find something we can use. We're getting low on ammo.
Jack and JB pulled out the corpses. Ryan got in the elevator and gently set Christie against the rear wall. She was lost in a deep and troubled sleep. The others followed him into the elevator. As Ryan straightened, Jack poked the illuminated button for the fourth floor. When the doors opened on the next level, all of the companions stood with their weapons drawn, ready to defend themselves. They were greeted not by kill-crazed mutants, but by pitch darkness. The light from the elevator penetrated only a few feet into the gloom. Then, one after another, the banks of ceiling lights flickered and started to come on. Some of the fluorescent tubes continued to flicker annoyingly. Others remained dark. Enough of them lit up for Ryan and friends to be able to see that there was no opposition down the long, windowless corridor.
Those are some long-life bulbs.
Probably keyed to movement or sound. Don't come on until someone triggers them. Saves wear and tear that way. JB, give Jack your scattergun. He can keep watch on the elevator, and Christie, while we wreck.
The armorer unslung his Smith & Wesson M4000 12 gauge and handed it to Jack. The white-haired teen automatically checked the breech for a live round, then found and tripped the car's control panel switch that locked the doors open and held the elevator in place. Ryan and the others leapfrogged down the hallway, kick-entering every room, making sure no muties were lying in wait, and that their backs and line of retreat were protected. They were closing in on the armory when JB stuck his head out of a doorway.
Hey, I found somebody in here. Looks like one of your pre-dark white coats, Doc. Don't get your hopes up, though. He's already well chilled.
Ryan, Mildred, and Doc followed JB into the room. It was a scientific laboratory with its own mainframe computer and a row of automated chemical analysis machines. The walls were lined with metal shelves bearing hundreds of stacked, labeled, sealed glass jars. Similar jars rested on the workstation counters and the floor. Ryan scanned some of the labels. The dates printed at the tops went all the way back to the days immediately after the nuclear holocaust. The room contained thousands of jars. Some were packed with what looked like wads of human hair and fingernail clippings. Others were filled with cloudy liquid in different shades of yellow and amber. Still others contained brown segmented coils of excrement suspended in clear fluid. A broad white writing surface on one wall displayed a hand-drawn graph in red. Numerous points on the parabola were marked with blue dots, and above the dots were numerical values in Greek letters. 5-foot-high stacks of computer spreadsheets stood beside the writing panel.
It's over here.
JB waved them to a big, wall-mounted freezer unit with smoked glass doors. Inside the freezer, a man-shape sat facing out, cross-legged, its arms folded over its chest. It was wearing a white lab coat. Ryan could just make out the round lenses of its eyeglasses under the hoary growth of frost. From the dates on the jars, the white coat had lived in the Redoubt for decades before pulling his own plug. While he had waited in the freezer to die, he had written something in the frost on the inside of the door with a fingertip. He'd written it backwards so anyone looking in at him could read it.
Science rules.
Ryan clapped the old man on the back.
Easy, Doc. You're gonna bust something important.
Thank you, Ryan.
All right, we don't have time for this. Let's get out of here.
The armory entrance they sought stood near the dead end of the corridor. It had a heavy, double-wide tempered steel door and a massive and still operational computer card lock.
Get us in, JB.
No problem.
The armorer dug around in the capacious side pockets of his pants and took out 2 wads of homemade C4 plastique, a blasting cap, some scraps of electrical wire, and a hand-twist, mechanically powered detonator. He bracketed the card lock with flattened gobs of C4, linked the charges, then fused them.
Out of the hall.
The others moved back as he unrolled the detonator's wire and backed into an open doorway. The companions hunkered down behind door jambs for cover.
Showtime.
Though a section of the overhead lights was extinguished by the blast, Ryan could see the massive door no longer had a lock and that it had slid back on its hidden floor tracks, thrown away from the jam by a good foot and a half. Then red lights concealed in the ceiling began to flash on and off.
Fire-blasted sex system. Ears or no ears, that's gonna bring stickies down on us. Let's check the armory quick.
It was a shame they had to hurry, because the Redoubt Armory was like an unguarded candy store. Nearly all of the century-old complexes they jumped to had been stripped bare, as the Redoubt's former occupants had evacuated the place, or had been looted by people who had broken into the upper levels. Usually, nothing of value remained.
Look at all the ammo! Unopened factory cans of 9mm and 5.56mm.
Grenades!
Doc used a scrap of rag he found to wipe the protective layer of grease from a flip-top anti-personnel device.
High explosive!
Ryan, there's reloads for caseless G12 assault rifles. The air-sealed pack's looking good shape.
I got laws over here. Check all the gun crates, JB. If there's caseless ammo, there might also be G12s. We could use the additional firepower.
The armorer poked around for a few seconds.
There's an open crate with 3 G12s inside. They look on fire.
Take them. The reloading units weigh about 2 pounds each. Take 2 dozen. 6 for each of us to carry out.
Right.
Christy hung suspended in blackness, ensnared by sticky webs of the lingering jump nightmare. She couldn't move so much as a fingertip. A prolonged, futile struggle to break free had drained her spirit's strength. The dream was in complete control of all she thought and felt. Like a spider's victim, first paralyzed by a toxic bite, then wrapped head to foot in wet silk, she believed that she had been seeded with alien life, dozens of baby monsters that would soon hatch in her belly and eat their way out of her.
Christy? Christy? Wake up, Christy.
The sound of her lover's voice was a lifeline, pulling her back toward his world, their world. The wraps of psychic silk loosened slightly, and Christy could feel a hard floor under her legs, a wall at her back. The insistent pull of gravity reconnected her to the source of all her muddy powers, Gaia, the Earth Mother.
Gaia.
She called on that feminine force, drawing it into herself. Her strength returned in a rush. She used it to drag herself from the clinging vestiges of the dream. Christy opened her eyes. At first, she couldn't figure out where she was, but she sensed a rapid upward movement and the presence of her comrades close at hand. Her eyes quickly adjusted to the light of the single caged bulb beside her. Encircling gray walls slipped past. She blinked up at a rectangular shaft made of reinforced concrete, realizing she was on the roof of an elevator.
Raya!
Oh!
A hand clamped firmly over her mouth. She looked up and saw Ryan. When she nodded that she understood, he removed his hand and tenderly brushed her cheek with his fingertips in a quick, welcome-back caress. There wasn't time for anything more. JB had the lid of the emergency exit hatch slightly ajar and stood crouched over it, waiting. The car swayed beneath them as it took on passengers. Holding her breath, Christy quietly rose to her feet. From under her fur coat, she drew her Smith & Wesson Model 640 handgun. Ryan reached over and tapped JB lightly on the arm. The armorer pulled the pin on the frag ren, silently counted to three, then dropped it through the gap and whirled away from the hatch. The car jolted sharply. The hatch lid jumped out of its frame, flipping off to one side. Heat and cordite smoke billowed through the opening, up into the concrete shaft. The caustic fumes burned Christy's throat and made her eyes water. The car started up to the next floor. Steel scraped against concrete, sending showers of sparks off into the darkness. The high-explosive grenade had bulged out the sides of the car, so it no longer quite fit the shaft.
I don't like the sound of that.
Me neither. No more grins, anyway. Better chill them with blasters next stop.
We're only moving half as quickly as before, as well.
We can always take the other car. Assuming this one gets us to the next floor.
Christy caught a quick movement at the very edge of her vision, near her feet. She reacted and had her gun up and tracking before she realized what it was. The sticky was already halfway out of the hatch. The slugs from Christy's gun punched through the sticky smooth forehead. It dropped back through the opening.
Good one.
Thanks.
The doors to the next floor loomed just overhead.
My time.
Jack picked up one of the new G-12s. He rotated the cocking knob, a round circle set flush in the stock behind the pistol grip.
Hold my legs so I don't fall.
The teenager positioned himself over the hatch opening. With JB and Ryan securing his ankles, he eased through it, hooking the backs of his knees over the edge of the frame. He hung upside down from the roof of the elevator like a white-haired bat.
Et toi!
Jack raised himself partway up, and JB and Ryan pulled him to his feet. He grinned as he wiped the spatters of blood and tissue from the sides of his face with the tail of his t-shirt.
Phew! Bastard Prime.
Christy understood Ryan's strategy, why he wasn't making a non-stop run for the surface, why he was hitting every floor on the way up. Like moths to a flame, the homicidal crazies lurking around the complex seemed to be drawn to the elevators. Even though they couldn't kill all of the stickies in the redoubt, the companions could make a serious dent in their numbers. Each one they killed now was one less they would have to deal with when they returned by this same route to jump out.
Are we going to switch elevators now?
Uh-oh. Too late for that. We got trouble.
As they all looked down, they could see the second elevator coming up from the bottom level. Even in the dim light, it was obvious that the roof of the car was loaded with stickies.
Dark night. Where'd they come from?
Must have transported in with the chamber open. The ones closest to the doorway probably got torn to shreds, but the rest of them made it through.
Their own elevator started up with a lurch.
Damn it. We're too slow. The other elevator's going to overtake us before we reach the top.
Grand time.
JB yanked the pin on another frag and lobbed the bomb into the midst of the stickies below. The elevator fell into darkness, the snapped cables twisting like beheaded snakes.
Everybody down in the car except you, JB. Fix the elevator so no one but us can use it.
Christie followed Ryan, dropping down through the hatch. The heels of her boots hit something soft and wet as her full weight hit the floor of the car. The others slipped down beside her. The inside of the elevator was a charnel house, the walls scorched and concave from the Gren explosion, dripping with fresh splatters of sticky blood. They booted chunks of the corpses aside and prepared to open fire the instant the doors parted. There was nothing alive to shoot at, just an enormous, low-ceilinged, concrete-floored room lit by tracks of overhead fluorescence. To the left, along the wall, were a dozen camouflage-painted, armor-plated wags parked there generations before. Ryan looked up the trapdoor at JB.
We're clear.
The armorer yanked the motor's power coupling, freezing the car on the redoubt's top floor. Then he hopped down to join his companions.
Ready.
They crossed the broad room in spread single file, on triple red alert, guns up and ready, heading for the row of APCs and Hummers. With the precision that comes from much practice, Ryan, Christie, and the others moved around the stored vehicles, sweeping for stickies in hiding. They found none.
These wags look operational.
JB stuck his head inside a Hummer.
The nuke batteries are showing full charge. I think this redoubt's anti-rad bunkering held up.
Ryan admired one of the two-track APCs. Its gun turret was set well forward on its squat, blocky body. The turret had four cannon barrels, and concealed in an armored bubble beside its top hatch, what looked to be a sophisticated electronic aiming system. Above the driver's obslit was an unfamiliar emblem, a solid red circle on a pale blue field.
That's a Mitsuki Meteor Fighting Vehicle, also known as the Mitsuki Meatball. I remember seeing a lot of news footage on it maybe 6 months before I went in for my surgery. The Asian Alliance started manufacturing them in 1998. They first saw combat in the conventional force battle of Hong Kong in the summer of 1999. The Meteor's missile defense system worked well against Taiwanese air-to-ground and ground-to-ground heat seekers. It produces a pulse of EM rad that throws a protective dome over it, makes incoming missiles veer off target at 60 or more degrees, which gives the Meteor's laser-guided 20-millimeter cannons time to lock on the enemy.
There aren't any more heat seekers to worry about.
Ryan used the hand and footholds to climb up to the turret.
But if this meatball runs, we could sure ride out of here in style.
I looked around inside.
This thing is big enough for all of us. Mildred, do you remember anything about the fuel range?
I remember it was excellent. Notice anything unusual about the hull?
He put his hand on it.
It's not cold.
That's because the armoring isn't steel. It's some kind of high-temp Kevlar armor-glass composite. It's very light for its strength, which adds to the fuel efficiency. I seem to recall that in the Hong Kong campaign, the Meteor was averaging a couple of 100 miles per tankful over mixed terrain.
Let's see if she'll start.
Ryan dropped down through the hatch. While Doc and Mildred stood guard, Jack, JB, and Christie picked up their gear and followed Ryan into the dark, cramped space. They had to climb around the gunner's chair, which was suspended in a metal cage from the inside of the turret. The Meteor's interior was cluttered with a latticework of structural braces, with conduits and cables wound in dull silver tape. At the front of the compartment were the driver's and co-pilot chairs. At the rear was a storage area that housed the power cells for the electronic systems. Rows of jump seats lined the rear side walls. Ryan slipped into the driver's seat and opened the obslit. It provided enough light so he could read the dials on the compact dash. He found the interior light switch. The compartment was bathed in red light.
Trader had himself a war wag kind of like this once. Two levers, one for steering and braking each track. An automatic tranny with four forward speeds, neutral and reverse. Here's the ignition. Fire blast. Maybe the white coats mothballed it.
Have you got oil pressure?
Yeah.
Ryan tapped the accelerator twice and hit the button again.
There you go. Let it run a while. Get the engine temp up and melt that 100-year-old grease. I'm going to check out the weapon system.
JB hauled himself up into the caged gunner's chair, removed his fedora, and pulled the target acquisition helmet over his head. After flipping down the VR visor, he reached out for the dual joystick fire controls. The instant he touched the sticks, the weapon system came on. There was a flutter of movement along both side walls of the rear compartment. Under the clutter of braces and conduit, Christy could see the chains of linked 20mm anti-tank cannon rounds that fed up from the magazine under the floor. JB turned his head to the left, and the turret followed suit. He twisted right, and the turret moved with him. Pleased with himself, he juked the joysticks.
Shit!
Hey, cut that out!
JB opened his hands at once, releasing the fire controls, but for the third Hummer down the line, it was too late. The accidental burst of HE rounds had already blown it in two.
JB, you sure you know what you're doing?
I wasn't, but now I am.
Doc! Mildred! Get in here! We're rolling!
When they were safely inside, and JB had dogged the turret hatch, Ryan shifted the APC into forward gear and pulled both steering braking levers toward him. The Meteor's tracks spun on the slick concrete, then caught hold.
That looks like the only way out.
Ryan headed for an opening at the far end of the room. He braked at the entrance to a rectangular tunnel. Jack tried to peer ahead through the co-pilot's op slit.
Dark in there.
Ryan searched the dash until he found the switch that controlled the halogen headlights.
How's that?
Now Jack could see that the tunnel sloped up and appeared to end in a solid wall after about 50 yards. Ryan drove the Meteor into the passage anyway. About a third of the way along, the APC's headlights illuminated a hard right turn, one of many tight switchbacks designed to deflect ground and airburst radiation. Ryan negotiated the turns carefully. The vanadium steel doors had just swung into sight, reflecting the glare of the headlights at the end of a long, straight section of tunnel, when Jack nudged Ryan with an elbow, pointing at the control panel.
What that mean?
A single gauge light flashed on and off.
I don't know.
The Meteor died 100 feet from the steel doors.
Fire blast. Everybody out. We're gonna have to walk after all.
Oh, no. Wasted time.
It was night outside. Ryan and the others turned their backs to the wind that whipped across the barren mountaintop. A bank of storm clouds raced east, away from them. Chains of lightning flashed at the storm's core, lighting up the ominous purple mass with bursts of sickly yellow. The ground at their feet still bubbled as the weak acids from a recent chem rain percolated into the soil. Overhead, between the scattered, straggler clouds, the stars were bright and the bone-white moon half full. Ryan, Mildred, Doc, and Christy fanned out and took up defensive positions around the doorway, guarding Jack's back while he tapped the redoubt's exit code into the keypad beside the double doors. The entrance slowly closed and its internal bolt shot home. Meanwhile, JB had his mini-sextant out, and in the gauzy light was trying to figure out where they were.
Well?
From the position of the moon, I'd say we're somewhere east of the Shens, not far from the Atlantic. Maybe the Carolinas.
The lovely Carolinas. What a bittersweet trove of memories this part of the world brings to mind. Emily, Rachel, Julian, and I had the pleasure of taking a brief holiday on the shores of the Outer Banks very long ago. I recall most clearly its distinctive, serene beauty, genteel folk, and most gracious hospitality.
Well, now it's just another rad-blasted hellhole. Smell the smoke?
How could I miss it? A stench to greet the nostrils of neophytes to hell.
Ryan narrowed his gaze. Something else was in the wind. Something more subtle. The scent of blood. Human blood. He shrugged it off as an illusion. Another flashback from his Matran's nightmare.
Fire's this way.
Jack headed into the wind. He climbed the mound of bare rock that framed one side of the ruin of a road. Ryan and the others followed him to the crest, and from there they looked down over a wide valley. A dozen miles away, on the far side of the basin, a tight cluster of orange lights danced.
A vill?
Yeah. My guess is it'll take us until nearly daylight to get over there.
Night march?
The Stickies aren't going to stop because of the dark. They like the night for hunting. We better get going.
At least the Stickies are going to be easy to track. Look at all that disturbance. Like walking in the wake of a tornado.
Yeah. Let's move.
Ryan quickly realized that Mildred wasn't moving from the crest.
Mildred?
She didn't respond. She stood perfectly still, staring intently at the distant flames. Ryan touched her arm.
You okay?
Mildred blinked and turned slowly to look at him.
Yeah, I think so.
With a troubled expression on her face, she forced herself to turn away from the vista.
I'm fine. Let's go.